Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and this is the post-Thanksgiving episode. Stone, you know, how'd you do in Thanksgiving?
I am fat and happy. We didn't travel very far this week. I went up to Dahlonega, and we stayed in this nice little set of villas at the Montaluce Winery and had the most marvelous time. And this little neighborhood that we were in is featured on a Hallmark movie out right now called Christmas in Homestead. Catch it Wednesday night. I'm recording it. And you'll get to see what marvelous digs we had for Thanksgiving. How about you?
I was in Los Angeles and had a great time there. I found some movie magic information as well. I did a tour of one of the studios, I think the Warner Brothers studio. And they used facades in their filming. They used the same facade in the movie Minority Report, which I know is one of your favorites.
Oh, yeah.
And Annie. The same facade as in both movies.
That makes perfect sense.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Well, this is going to be a fantastic show today. A little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to visit with business development manager with Big Green Egg, Ryan. His name is Jerry Stone. We're probably related somewhere up the line. We'll find out. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to welcome to the broadcast, CEO with Sales Fusion, Miss Carol O'Kelly. How are you?
I'm great. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Sales Fusion, can you share a little bit about what you guys are doing for folks?
Absolutely. Sales Fusion provides a marketing automation platform that's designed especially for the needs of small and mid-sized businesses. So, it's everything from email marketing to helping track web visitors and everything that allows you to follow the buyer through the journey of becoming a customer.
And then how are you defining small and mid-sized business?
That's a great question. We would say that we work primarily with customers who have about $5 million a year in annual revenue up to those who have $200 million a year of annual revenue. Quite a range.
Right. That is a range. The needs obviously are different at each stage. How do you kind of customize the tool for each company?
The platform is the same regardless of the size of the company, but the level of support and service that we provide varies enormously. One of the fastest growing part of our business is something we called managed services. Mm. And that's where we actually go on the journey of implementing marketing automation with our client. And we can either provide a level of support when they're getting started, where we build the initial templates that they're going to use, or we can partner with them over the long term and actually run all of their marketing programs for them using our platform. That allows smaller companies with fewer resources to stay focused on the things they're really good at, like creating the actual campaigns and offers and marketing content. And we do the more mundane tactical work in the platform and the reporting.
Now, is this work well in certain industries or is this kind of work well across the board?
It's interesting. We have half of our customers are business to consumer clients and half of them are business to business clients. And we do have a couple of niches. We, of course, work with a lot of business to business technology companies. And we also work with a number of with pro sports franchises, particularly the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Okay. Help me understand the application for a pro sport franchise.
Well, they have to market those season tickets to somebody.
Oh, all right. Okay. All right.
So it's to help them sell season tickets, or does it also evolve into selling luxury boxes and suites and sponsorship and things like that?
Absolutely.
As well?
It does all of those things. And the platform allows you to segment all of the target companies into different lists. So, for example, you might have one list that you're marketing your luxury boxes to, another list that you're marketing your season tickets to, another that you're marketing one-off packages throughout the season, and others where you're marketing sponsorships. And you can run different campaigns targeted all of those audiences and do each of them in an automated way.
Because in that case, I would think that some of that is a B2C sale and some of it is a B2B. So it's able to integrate all of that.
Exactly. And that's what makes Sales Fusion unique. A lot of marketing automation platforms are geared only for business to business or only for business to consumer. Mm-hmm. And we are able to handle the needs of both.
So I want to get a little insight on this whole idea of campaigns, because I know I personally am very susceptible, even in our business here at the Business Radio X Network. I come in one day and say, we need more sponsors. We got to get busy getting more sponsors. Let's get an email out. But it needs to be more systematic than that, and you need to be providing value. It's almost like you guys creating an in our vernacular, an editorial calendar, right? Where you're communicating over time.
You're absolutely right, Jerry. That is the right way to think about it. The one-off sort of, you know, quick hits of an email here or there are not very effective anymore. And you really need to take an overarching campaign approach to the messaging that you're providing people. Yeah, typically, you need to be in front of a prospective customer four or five times before you're going to gain any traction. So, you know, one-shot emails aren't going to have the level of engagement that you're looking for. Things have really changed in the marketing world lately, in the last, you know, 20 years, that's more than lately. But if you think about the way that you buy a car and the way that that's changed in our lifetimes, it's a great model for the way marketing has changed. It used to be when you wanted to buy a car, you showed up at the car lot and you engaged with a salesperson, and then they had your phone number, they knew where you were, they were in control of the process. Today, when you go to buy a car, the very last thing you do is step onto a car lot. In fact, many of us don't step onto a car lot at all if we can avoid it. In that way, the consumer is in control. They're doing all of their research and education, typically online. They're trying to remain anonymous as long as possible so that they aren't engaged with a salesperson. Tools like marketing automation allow the seller to be in communication in a way that the consumer, whether that's a business consumer or a consumer, is comfortable with. And you're able to provide them content that allows them to look smart and find all the information that they need, yet you're able to track their journey and understand when are they warming up to become a right prospect.
Now, you mentioned that your service also includes service, not just a blanket kind of software that just does some automated tasks. Can you walk us through how that progresses? Because I would think that that requires a certain level of customization and hand-holding that a lot of these marketing automation companies in general try to avoid at all costs.
Right. So we tailor every managed services engagement to the needs of the particular client. So we might have someone who just needs migration services at the beginning of a project where they perhaps have been using another marketing automation platform or an email platform and they have a nice size marketing team and we're just helping them get started maybe for a 3 or 6 month engagement alongside. In that case, we go ahead and we train the client on how to use the platform and we're focused on going through the first couple of campaigns with them with sort of the thinking that you learn by doing, not by being told. So when I drive somewhere, I know how to get there. If I ride and I'm in the passenger seat, I don't often know how to get there. So we try to allow our clients to be the drivers in those scenarios so that they retain the information or are able to do the work on their own. In other cases, we look at clients who say, well, we don't have a lot of marketing automation experience and we have very limited resources. And they want someone who can say, all right, your expertise, Sales Fusion, is marketing automation. So you're going to run the platform for me. You're going to do all of the tactical setting up of campaigns and sending of emails and creating reports for me and be an extension of my team. And the way we've structured our business is that we actually treat the managed services component of our business as a loss leader. In many cases, we make no money on managed services. But for us, we reap the rewards longer term when the client becomes a happy, long-standing customer of the platform. And it's been a very successful business model for us.
Can you share some kind of success stories about how people have leveraged maybe both sides of this, where they just said, okay, I can plug and play and I'll just, you know, I know how to do this and I'm going to just use the service, and somebody that you were able to kind of handhold a little bit and help them become successful?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I can give you examples of Atlanta-based companies for both of those.
All right.
There's a company called Decision Link that Jim Berryhill founded down at the Atlanta Tech Village. A very small company, but very, very savvy, experienced sales and marketing folks, but with a, you know, one-person marketing team. And so they came to us about a year ago and said they wanted to use marketing automation. They knew that their larger, more sophisticated competitors had access to these types of tools that you often see, you know, enterprise companies have access to, and they wanted to know how could DecisionLink take advantage of those. So we are actually operating the platform for them. They do all of the content creation themselves. They create their own lists and decide who they're marketing to. And then we do, not only do we execute the campaigns and build their reports, but we also do some strategic consulting to them where we challenge them around best practices and ensure that they're not just using the most elementary elements of the platform, but that they're continuing to challenge themselves as a business and start to use some of the more advanced features. We started with them doing a series of email campaigns, and now they're now even experimenting with social marketing and seeing some success from that. The other example I would give is a company in Atlanta called Canvas IT. They have a stronger marketing resources internally, so they're actually running the platform themselves. But they, again, were looking to have the types of marketing technology that would allow them to compete with the larger competitors in their space. And they were very committed to having the resources internally. So we did an initial training with them. And then, of course, our support organization is available to them online and via the phone. And they've been able to be successful with the platform independently.
Now, does your service, is it replace existing marketing automation, or does it play nicely with it?
Typically, we are replacing either an email marketing solution or another marketing automation platform. But more than half of our customers have never used marketing automation before.
Oh, wow.
In those cases, they may have been using an email platform, but they're looking to really increase the level of engagement that they have with their customers beyond just basic email capability. And so, for example, they want to look at how am I interacting with my prospects on my website? What type of content are they downloading? How are they interacting with my social marketing programs? And be able to create a lead score that looks across all of those different marketing channels and measures when those customers are becoming ready to make a purchasing decision.
And they're moving down the sales funnel.
Absolutely.
Now, I don't know, maybe we're just kind of jaded here in Atlanta because there's so many marketing automation companies here. What's the penetration of companies that are using some sort of marketing automation?
Well, it's really interesting. You hit the nail on the head. We are a little bit jaded in Atlanta because this is such a hotbed for marketing technology. If you look back to what David Cummings did in the early days of founding Pardot in Atlanta, that was really the beginning of marketing automation. But that wasn't that long ago. And at the point that David sold the company to ExactTarget, they had only about $10 million in revenue. If you look at reports from companies like Gartner, they'll tell you that less than 10% of the companies that could be using marketing automation are using it today. And if you look at small and mid-market companies, that penetration is actually less than 7%. So there's still an enormous opportunity.
Wow.
Right. But because we saw Pardot be purchased at the early adopter phase of this cycle, that we have come to believe in Atlanta that, marketing automation, everybody has it. It's quite the opposite. There's still an enormous opportunity.
So I have to know, what's your backstory? How did you get involved in this kind of work?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. I spent the last 25 years in sales and marketing for technology companies. I had the opportunity to work for a company called Retech, where I was the 34th employee. We grew to be over 700 employees before being purchased by Oracle. And so I spent my formative years in technology working for a company that was growing very, very quickly. And I had the guts to raise my hand and say I would do anything that they'd let me do. And so I have had the opportunity to work in almost every area of a technology company and found my home in marketing and have loved that ever since.
Do you remember the trade show that we did? It was like Oracle Open World,
right.
And it was that year.
It's insane.
We're doing our little interview. We take this stuff on the road, and all of a sudden we hear the whole auditorium just erupts. And it was
an earthquake.
It was the year that the guy won the race.
Larry Ellison won the America's Cup.
And he was supposed to be the keynoter, and he blew it off to go watch them.
I don't
the race.
Blame him. I had the opportunity to attend some of the races in Valencia, and it was a great experience. Oracle really does that right.
Yeah, they don't mess around.
So you touched a moment ago on the idea of best practices. I wonder if we could dive into a couple worst practices, or better yet, just some of the, I get the sense that you and your team probably see some patterns over time. And what are some major mistakes or some things that we all should just avoid in our marketing?
Sure.
Communication.
We do see a lot of people make mistakes, but we consider it our mission to make people successful with marketing technology. Our chief marketing officer and myself, between us, have implemented marketing automation at other companies prior to coming to Sales Fusion a number of times. And we'll both tell you, there have been times we've done it with great effectiveness, and there have been times when there were bodies on the side of the road. And it's our, you know, we consider it almost the altruistic part of our work is to make sure that other marketers don't make the same mistakes that we've made. So anyone that's making mistakes is in very, very good company. That said, I would say that the main things that people make the mistake of doing is thinking that when you implement marketing technology, that the platform is in and of itself all that you need. And that's absolutely not the case. That selecting the platform is just the very first step on the journey. You then have to understand how to adopt the business processes, how to make sure that your sales and marketing organizations are staying aligned, how to make sure that you're putting together the types of content and offers that are really interesting to your potential buyers. The worst thing you can do is just fire email after email after email to people and have them click the unsubscribe button. Huge mistake. You don't want to lose your audience. So you have to think about what content, what offer is interesting to the person that I want to do business with. How am I going to be seen as a valued business partner and not someone who's spamming them?
Now, how do you create that content? That's a job unto itself.
I mean, a
lot of these companies, like you said, they think that I just buy this tool, whatever it is, and then I'm done. And then somehow, you know, I'm going to get leads.
Right.
And it requires a lot of infrastructure in order to execute that. And I know that your firm also helps in that area.
Sure.
But just the content creation and the identifying what is the valuable content, that to me seems it's a big pivot for a lot of companies to even think in this manner.
Absolutely. And I think that is the single greatest mistake people make when they adopt marketing technology is that they haven't thought through the content. So I think that when you think about implementing marketing automation or any marketing technology, you need to think not just about the cost of the platform and the resources it'll take to actually operate the platform, but the resources and the cost that will be associated with creating any content that you might need. So there are creative ways to go about doing that. You can look to what types of materials exist already inside the company that can be potentially repackaged. You can look to subject matter experts inside your own company who may not actually be people in the marketing department. There may be people in the engineering organization or in the sales organization who have deep expertise in what it is that you're selling. So you go to those folks and you may want to pair them with a writer from the marketing department, but you can almost use a journalistics approach to getting that information out of the mind of the experts. And then, of course, you can partner with a third party to create content. And there are a lot of people that have a lot of businesses, agencies that have specifically developed here that their expertise is in building content. We actually build very little content for our customers. We work with them, and we think that that's where they provide the greatest expertise is in their own product offering. But we provide a lot of very candid feedback about that content. We will have customers come to us and say, oh, well, my open rate was not what I expected, or my click-through rate wasn't up to industry standard, or my unsubscribe rate seemed really high. And the first thing we do is say, let me see the email. Let's see the campaign. What was the offer? Well, there's no call to action here. You said, we hope we see you at the upcoming trade show. What?
Okay.
What's the value in that? Maybe you should ask them to, you know, click here to download a white paper about something that's of interest to them. Maybe you should invite them to a specific event at the trade show. And sometimes it can be awkward to have those conversations with clients. But again, we consider it our business to make them successful with marketing technology. So we can either have the awkward conversation now and help make them successful, or we can have the awkward conversation when renewal time comes and they're disappointed with the results.
And that's too late.
Yeah.
Now, if you say that your service is X, what is the cost of creating the content? Is it 2X? Is it X again?
Oh, that's a great question. I would say that it is... It depends on the business that you're in. There are a lot of businesses where you can build a content library where you can reuse and repurpose that content again and again. So create once and use many times. And it just depends on what you're selling. So for example, if you're selling cars, your buyer changes and there may be a certain set of content that someone needs to read during the journey of purchasing a car. Well, let's imagine that that's a 30-day journey. Well, they buy their car at the end and now you're on to marketing to someone else and you may be able to use that same content again and again.
But there's also a new car.
Absolutely. So gotta... Absolutely. And in that case, in some cases, you have things that can just be updated. And of course, in cars not being a great example because they are such major consumer brands and the quality of the collateral that and the photography, et cetera, and the brand work that goes into that are very high end. But for the purposes of someone who is in a more traditional small or mid-sized business, it's often a matter of updating content that you already have. It can be curating content that comes from other places. So for example, you might decide to do a newsletter into your customer base and not just use all original content that you've created, but you can potentially link and curate the content of other news sources that are of interest to your audience.
But let's take your industry, marketing automation. So the type of content that you're providing is just general, here's how to do email campaigns, here's how to create content, here's how to do those kind of the blocking and tackling of your industry. But then do you also niche it out to, okay, we're targeting technology firms, so we have specific how to create emails for technology or healthcare. We create, you know, because they're all a little different.
Sure. So in our business, we're lucky in that marketing technology is largely consistent from one vertical to the next. You can almost think of it as a horizontal application that goes across a lot of different industry verticals. Now, certainly, you're going to receive greater engagement with any particular vertical if you are tailoring the content to that particular vertical. So for example, if I want to market to professional sports teams, I'm going to lead with a case study from one of my existing professional sports organizations.
So is a case study an example of content that everybody should be putting together?
Yes, I think so, because people care a lot more about what a third party's experience was with your platform than what you as the CEO of a company says that your company's doing for someone.
So now, if you were to put together your list of three must-have pieces of content, what would they be? You mentioned case study.
Yep, I would say case study. I would say anything that's a buying guide, so that can help someone make them feel smart through the process of making the decision, give them the list of questions they ought to be asking not only you, but your competitors. And then I would say that there should be some sort of piece, it can just even be an article or a blog posting, that's something that's very timely and sort of a current event or topic that is hot in your space or industry at that time.
So now that's something you have to create on an ongoing basis. The other two you can
repurpose.
Mm-hmm. Carol, he was fishing for Lee Cantor interview. Transcript from Lee Cantor.
Yeah. That's a great piece of content.
You mentioned a term earlier in the conversation that I'd like to talk a little bit about before we wrap, because it really intrigues me. So let's just talk about it. Lead scoring.
Yes.
I guess part of me is saying, can that really be done? Is that valid? And is that going to save me?
Okay, yeah. Absolutely. So lead scoring is just the simple practice of assigning a point value to every interaction your prospect has with you. So you send them an email. Did they open it? Did they click through? Did they download the content? Did they attend a webinar? Did they come to your website? All of those things have a point value, and they aren't necessarily an equal point value. Clicking through on an email might only receive 1 point, whereas coming to my website and filling out a form and downloading a piece of gated content might be a 50-point activity. And you can decide what your threshold is for measuring engagement, and then you pass those leads over to your sales organization, and you can say, hey, this person has raised their hand again and again. One of the nice things about lead scoring is that you can change the threshold over time. So imagine that you're a business where you need more leads. I've never met the business that didn't need more leads. So you can have a relatively low lead scoring hurdle. But as your pipeline grows, you can raise the hurdle so that you're only passing the most qualified leads over to the sales organization.
Well, and I would think that you would also learn what weight to assign to what factors. Maybe we gave a little too much credence to time on website, and but the boy, the ones that download this white paper, that you would learn that with real data over
absolutely.
Time.
Right? Okay. Absolutely. Absolutely. And you have to, that's one of the things we encourage people to start using lead scoring from the very first day that they use marketing automation. So they're collecting that data. Even if they're not doing anything with it initially, they're collecting that data so that when they are ready to use it 6 months down the line, that they have a good storehouse of information.
Now, when you're working with your customer, do you help them kind of with their sales funnel? Like how many pieces need to be in this? How many emails back and forth should move them from, you know, active lead to a nurturing, a drip campaign?
Yes. So we do a couple of things. First of all, because we're marketers, we have a pretty reasonable amount of experience with the sales funnel ourselves. And so we can help them understand what are the best practices and what types of response rates and how often and how with what frequency you should be engaging with your prospects and how you should see them moving. But we can also help them do some planning around what their sales and marketing funnel needs to look like. And we do a lot of that actually at this time of year as people are starting to make their budgets and plans for the next fiscal year. They'll often come and say, I need a sounding board. I need you to help me think this through. What would my conversion rate need to be at each stage of the funnel? What volume of opportunities do I need to have? And what are the different activities I can do to accelerate the movement through the funnel?
Now, in your case, what is your, like, who is your prospect? Is it the chief marketing officer? Is it the CEO? Who is the person you want to get in front
of? It depends
on
this
conversation.
Sure. It depends on the size of the business. We find that the VP of marketing is often the decision maker, or the chief marketing officer is often the decision maker. And so that would be our buyer persona, but our user persona is something different entirely. The chief marketing officer is not often the person that's in the marketing automation platform. Mm-hmm. And so we need to market to multiple levels of the org chart. So we're looking even at marketing managers and marketing analysts, and we're trying to have multiple touch points in a particular account.
And then how, because it is complex like that, so you have content that's for the person that isn't going to make the decision, but it's useful for that person so they can champion it up the ladder. And then you have information for the person who is buying it to explain the ROI and things like that.
Exactly. So we have the ability to create a value assessment and tell, you know, what we believe that the return will be on the investment in marketing technology. And we package that in a way that we can actually give it to a marketing manager or a marketing analyst. And that document can almost stand on its own when they go to their VP or their CMO or even the CFO. And we are always say that we're welcomed, available to get on the phone and help talk people through that and in a consultative way.
Sounds like good stuff to me. Where can our listeners go if they'd like to learn more?
Salesfusion.com is the best place to go for additional information.
And what is the pain that they're having? Are they outgrowing their existing email? Is that the
typically?
Basis?
Yeah, they're typically outgrowing the existing email platform, or they're struggling to fill the funnel and sort of move into the modern era of marketing. They want to be competitive.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you on the show this morning. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, listen, can you hang out with us while we visit with our next guest?
I wouldn't miss it.
All right. Lee, you ready for the headliner?
All right.
This gentleman, we'll call him cousin, has been very patient. But I feel like you got a lot of good stuff out of that last conversation. I saw you taking copious notes.
I did take some notes, yes. We all need marketing. I don't care who you are. You got to have it.
That voice of wisdom that you hear now is from business development manager with Big Green Egg, Mr. Jerry Stone. Welcome to the show, man.
Glad to be here. Glad to be here.
How's your marketing automation working at Big Green Egg?
Well, that's why I was taking some notes. I might have to talk to Caro after the show, and we'll work something out.
So Big Green Egg, for those who don't know, can you share a little bit about the product and the history?
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of people don't realize that Big Green Egg is an Atlanta-based company. Yeah, we've been in business since 1974. And people go, wow, I never knew that. But, you know, the history of the company is Ed Fisher, who's a founder and started the business, he was in the Navy and serving in World War II in Japan. And in Japan, the soldiers over there saw that these round Kamado-shaped things that they were using to steam rice in. And, you know, they were having a craving for some good old barbecue. So they said, you know what, I bet we can convert that thing and use the charcoal in it, put a grate in it, and make it out of barbecue. And it turned into be a vessel that, you know, created a lot of moisture, and it cooked a long time. And so when the war ended, people started importing them over, and Ed had a wisdom and forethought to bring a couple containers over and opened up a little retail store on Claremont Avenue right here in Atlanta. And, you know, 37 years later, he's got quite a business and quite a following from our what we call our egghead community.
Now, was it always the Big Green Egg, or was it the just the regular green egg?
The little green egg?
That's a great question, too. You know, originally, it was called an Imperial Kamado, which is what he was importing. But what really changed the business was Ed was looking for a better material. And the Imperial Kamado was made out of fire clay. And the clay is great, but you couldn't get it very hot, or it would crack. And therefore, it was more of a smoker. And that's why it used to be called the world's greatest smoker, because you couldn't really get it real hot. So Ed was trying to find a way to get that issue off the table. And he luckily ran into some people at Georgia Tech and asked them some of the right questions. And they said, we think we know somebody that could help you. And it led us to the ceramic material that we have today, and allowed us to put a lifetime warranty on the product. Allowed it to go to very, very high temperatures, and you didn't have to worry about it cracking. So 1996 is what really changed the business model, and that's when it was called Big Green Egg, 1996.
And then you mentioned the community. What'd you call them?
Egghead community.
Egghead community. Now, did that just happen organically over time? People just became fanatic about it, and they just kind of formed themselves, or was that kind of a marketing effort on your company's part?
Yeah, Lee, that's a great question, too. We, you know, we're probably the first company that had social media before social media was popular.
Before it was cool.
You know, it'd be the guy who would smell something across the fence, and he'd go, hey, what is that over there? And, well, come over here, let me show you. And what really happened was this community got together in Atlanta. It was about seven or eight guys, and they said, let's bring all our grills together and let's cook and share some recipes. And that was called Egg-toberfest, which is now
Egg-toberfest.
So, you know, there's a theme here.
It was a good thing you made the move to call it the Big Green Egg, because it would have been what was it, Kamado Fest?
Exactly.
Rolls right off the tongue.
But it's very organic, you know, and that started actually, 20 years, next year will be our 20th anniversary of having this Egg-toberfest. Again, that's just a celebration of people coming together, experiencing the egg, and enjoying the social part of it.
So your first personal experience with the egg or food from the egg, do you recall it?
Yeah. You know, I kind of grew up, my uncle and my grandfather were the big grillers, you know, and you'd go out back, and as a young kid, you just knew the food was better off of it. And so I was always enjoyed cooking and et cetera. I actually owned an Imperial Kamado grill back when it was way back before it was called a Big Green Egg. So it's been about 25 years ago. But the first thing I cooked was a turkey. And I was talking to Carol out in the lobby this morning, and she was asking me about, you know, the turkey. And obviously that's one of the biggest things that people use this time of year is a turkey. But that was my first meal off one, and I knew right then there was something different about it.
Our family enjoyed a fantastic turkey made on the Big Green Egg just Thursday.
Oh, is that right?
Absolutely. And I was getting some tips from Jerry to understand how can I calibrate the temperature thermometer, and why does it cook faster if it's been brined? So this has been quite a learning experience for me today.
Yeah, and that's one of the beauties of the product. You know, it's very aspirational, but at the end of the day, it does a fantastic job. And it makes an average cook a good cook, a good cook a great cook. And today we have over 1,000 restaurants that in both in the U.S. and Europe that use the egg in the restaurant itself.
Now, I'm fascinated by the community component of this, because it's, it's not inexpensive. This is, like you said, an aspirational product. And the people just love it. Like, they're just kind of, it's like Comic-Con for grills, right? Like, you know, it's just, the people are just fanatic, and they just have their own methodology, and they love to share. And you have on your website forums for them to do just that. And that's an important, probably helps you in your growth. It definitely helps you differentiate. You know, from a marketing standpoint, I'm sure Carol will agree, this is the gold standard of what you're shooting for, right?
Yeah, money can't buy a tribe like that. You know, the idea of having people who bond together and identify as a group without the company's involvement, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and people love to share. You said the right word. You know, you can be anywhere. You know, Carol was excited to share it with me today because she had a great experience. And that's really at the end of the day, it's what it's about. But no matter where you are, people, hey, let me show you what I cooked on the egg, or, you know, so it's one of those product lines. It's very good. And a big part of our success is how we go to business. We go through what we call the independent sales network.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the easiest way to go because there's a lot of temptations to go to the big box guys and internet, those kinds of things. But way back when Ed started the business and we started going to a distribution network, you know, he knew that the consumer needed somebody to show how to use it. Somebody needed to demo it out in front of the store. And he used to cook chicken wings out on Claremont Avenue, and, you know, they'd bring people in, and that got the conversation going. And so, you know, our current business model today is all through an independent dealer network.
And that's because it does take some explaining. This isn't something that the average person, you just buy it in a box and then turn the propane on and then you're good to go.
Exactly. And it does take, you know, some commitment from, you know, the independent network. They're so skin in the game, I guess is the way I'd want to say it. You know, when you bring in a product line like that, you know, they've got some investment into the product line, and they want to make sure that their sales associates are doing a good job.
So,
with the product.
So sales training must be an important component of your business, to be able to go out to them and have some method of explaining how it works, how to get the most out of it?
It is. And once you kind of get some of that going, then you can kind of stand out of the way and let the customer do the selling for you.
Uh-huh.
That's one of the easiest ways of doing it, because they will. You know, we always say, hey, you know, Stone, do you have a Big Green Egg? And if you're in the store and Stone says, yeah, then Hey, Lee, this is Stone. Stone, how's that Big Green Egg going?
And typically,
for you?
I'm happy to do it, right?
And you'll
show off what I know and how to manage the airflow.
He'll spend 15 minutes telling you about it, and then you come back up, hey, you want the Visa, MasterCard, Express? I mean,
but some companies are hesitant to trust the consumers in that manner. Do you find that to be true, Carol, that to unleash the masses on your product, they might do things that you as corporate may not agree with or may not have thought of? And it's kind of giving some control to the individual.
Yeah, it does. But I don't think that it's something that you can fight. I think that you have to turn that into an advantage. And I think that's certainly what it sounds like the Big Green Egg has done. I know that when you walk in my local Ace Hardware, they have their Big Green Egg display right up front. And there's always a crowd there sharing ideas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jerry and his team can't always be out there to control and moderate that conversation. But they stand behind their product and they know that people love it. And it speaks for itself.
I can tell you my experience. My nephew, Max, he lives here in town. He has a Big Green Egg. And I think I get as much enjoyment out of just watching him explain to me what he's doing and why he's doing it and adjusting the temperature. And particularly if Uncle Howie, his father, my brother-in-law, if we're all out there, it's this whole ritual that it creates more than just great food. It's this whole experience around it. I love it.
You think about the holidays when everyone's standing around the kitchen. Now everyone stands around the big green egg.
Now, when you're going to market, you mentioned now restaurants are using that. Is that a recent development, or I'm sure there was always kind of a few renegades out there, but now it's becoming more and more popular?
Yeah, Europe is a big market for us. You know, in Europe, they're more into the foodie scene. That's certainly come to the U.S. market now. But, 10 years ago, that wasn't necessarily that way. But, you know, the Big Green Egg, since it uses all natural charcoal and it's outdoors, and so the Europeans really adopted it. And so a lot of the chef community over there decided to bring them in into their restaurants to show off the...
How do you get the word out to that community? Because that's kind of a niche community. Or do you have a special forum just for chefs?
No, that's something we're working on. I mean, through our website, we do have what we call a culinary partner program. that you as a consumer can go to that and see what, you know, restaurants are mm-hmm. involved in that program. And then through our distributor network, we have a program that encourages them to go out and, you know, search for those culinary chefs. But a lot of them come to us, quite honestly, and they're trying to figure out a way to incorporate that, you know, the flavor of the Big Green Egg into the restaurant.
But how do they do it at scale where they have, you know, it's one thing where you're doing it for your family, but another thing to do it for hundreds of people who are coming to the restaurant.
More green eggs. You need a dozen.
I like the way Lee's thinking here. Well, you know, that's another good question. We actually have 7 sizes of the Big Green Egg, and we have one that was called the Double XL.
I'm very familiar with that.
We came out with that one 2 years ago in response to the culinary catering business. So it's a very large egg that you can cook a lot of food off of.
This charcoal, by the way, this is very specific charcoal. If you guys are not aware of this, is Max will not put, you know, Acme charcoal in this Big Green Egg.
And there's a good reason for that. A lot of people don't know this, but it's all oak and hickory wood. It's all sourced in the U.S. And so there's a distinctive flavor profile, we call it.
Mm-hmm.
And our European chefs who love that charcoal so much, they say it's an ingredient for them. Mm-hmm. It is like salt and pepper. It's that flavor of that oak and hickory mix that really turn some of the dishes into what they really like to.
So you're exporting the charcoal, from here in the U.S. overseas?
You bet, yep.
Wow. Yeah. So a couple of weeks ago, I was in D.C. McLean, Virginia is where we were. We went to the organic butcher shop. My daughter lives up there.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, they had the Big Green Egg. They had the charcoal. But, I mean, this is a high-end butcher shop. The meat was not inexpensive. It was absolutely delicious. But that's the kind of people that you partner with in these markets.
Yeah, exactly. And the butchers are kind of making a comeback too in the U.S., which is great and great for all of us. I see a bunch of heads going, yeah. it's that community of, you know, right now our number one class of trade is the hardware community, the Independent Hardware Network. And then we do a lot of business through the pool and patio community, the pool
spa guys,
which is our number two class of trade. And then the hearth and fireside. There's not as much in the southern states, but in the northern states, there's a lot of hearth and fireside shops, and they're looking for another product that they can bring in to supplement their income when in the summertime. And, it's one of those brands that we only sell it through that network. So that individual dealer knows that he doesn't have to compete with the big box up the street. He doesn't have to compete with the internet. We don't allow...
Don't sell it on the internet.
Don't sell on the internet.
Oh, wow.
So you as an individual business owner, you've got a product that has a great following. It's very aspirational, and you can only get it at your location. And so that means a lot for that community of independent owners.
That's an interesting point. You can't purchase the Big Green Egg over the internet, but you're still using the internet to foster the sense of community, to have your home chefs sharing information and recipes. You provide a lot of content through your own website.
Right.
So you're embracing that side of that channel.
Yeah, and that's a big part of who we are is, you know, the social media, as we talked earlier, so the Facebooks and Instagram and all those accounts. We have a full-time person that does nothing but social media for the company, and we're a small group. We're still less than 50 employees in the company, but we're kind of a worldwide brand. So we're always fighting the battle of, trying to see what's going to be next in the marketing world, too. But social media is a big, big, big part of who we are.
Now, when you go to these niches that you serve, are you going to trade shows, or are you just kind of on the internet letting people know that you exist and serving the independent dealers?
Yeah, we get involved with all the trade shows within those channels. So we're going to the pool and spa show every year, and we're going to the patio show. We're going to the hardware show every year. We're getting in front of those individual owners that way. And then we also advertise in those trade magazines. And when we go to a trade show, we obviously want to get new customers, new dealers, but really we're there to make sure the brand's out in front of that whole community so they know we're very supportive of it. We're there to look for new products that might be popping up that somebody else might have that we might have an interest in or keep up with our competition. And then also it's just the social part of it. We usually are involved in cooking out with the eggs and doing some kind of a program at the event itself.
So now if an independent dealer, you're always looking for more, right? You're always looking for...
Always, yeah.
And you're always looking to serve that community.
You bet.
And then, so what's their, they're looking to expand their product line. They're looking to just have another offering. Is that typically how they come into your...
Yeah, they're, you know, if you're in the grill business, we would hope the Big Green Egg pops up. You know, obviously we're based here in Atlanta, and in the Southeast, the name is a lot better known. But there's parts of the country, the West Coast, the Midwest, where the Big Green Egg is. Yeah, hey, I kind of heard of it, but not really sure what it is. And some of the dealer networks the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're in that grill industry, the Big Green Egg, we actually say no to a lot more people than we say yes to. And sometimes it's because it's a situation where they don't have enough space in the store to allocate to the brand itself, or maybe there's a competing dealer that it's too close to that location. But for them to bring it in, it's you know, half of our sales are the egg itself and the other half of the accessory side.
Right.
So it's a great be back business for a dealer. You know, come in and get the charcoal that mm-hmm. Stone talked about. Come back in and get wood chips and pizza pills. And, you know, we have over 400 accessories that go along with the Big Green Egg.
And then you're always looking now for more chefs that are open to it, more restaurants?
You bet. Yeah, that's a culinary side is a big part of who we are. And we're looking to do a lot more of that, you know, in the U.S. market for sure.
And if somebody wanted to learn more, the website for you guys?
Well, it's called biggreenegg.com. I don't know how we came up with that, but I
worked that for you.
Marketing department.
And the Egghead Forum, if you're one of the Big Green Egg nerds.
Yeah.
To get the latest and greatest, right?
There's a lot of great recipes, a lot of sharing on there, and a lot of tips. And in fact, the turkey holiday we all just experienced was this tremendous amount of traffic on our website. So it's been a lot of fun.
All right. Before we wrap, though, what's your best turkey tip for Christmas?
Wow, good turkey tip. Well, I like to brine. We talked to Carol about brining earlier.
So brine first.
Brine first. You know, no matter if you're going in the oven or not into a Big Green Egg or whatever you're cooking, I would always brine. It adds moisture to the bird.
Mm-hmm.
Big Green Egg doesn't dry things out, but you know, if you're in the oven, that you might not have that opportunity. So I'd brine, and then you know, 350 to me is the magic number.
Just for a long time.
Well, for about 20 minutes a pound. Now, if you want to smoke a turkey, you could go 275 and go for 7 or 8 hours, and you get the more of the smoke in it. It just depends on what your profile or your tastes are.
And then complement with boneless ribeye.
That
would be a good combo.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.